Do you remember where you got your computer information in the 90s?
Probably from the Sugar Shack.
I definitely, by the late 90s for sure, maybe even mid. I remember I used to get PC Magazine, like that came to the house.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. I'm jumping the gun a little bit here. Sugar Shack, that stuff would have been, Quake didn't even come out till 96.
I think it was the Quake Holio also.
Yes. I started on the Quake Holio, but I figured most people would know it by its later moniker. But yeah, you're right. Yeah. It was probably more magazines in 96. We got our first internet connection in 96, but it was, a lot of Computer Shopper and probably PC Magazine or PC World.
Okay, so I'm enough of a nerd that I saw a Computer Shopper when I was at like the B. Dalton, I guess, was our bookstore in town. And I was like, I flipped through and I was like, this is all ads. I don't want this. So I just put it back on the shelf and never bought one. But I signed up. I'm going to go ahead and tell you a secret. If you told PC Magazine that you were a CIO,
uh-huh,
or CTO, uh-huh, they would just send you the subscriptions basically for free. It was like $6 a year or something. Yeah. So I got PC Magazine illicitly for years.
Holy shit, man. If I had only known.
Yeah. You work for a 500 person company and you're the CTO. Yes. We will send you a copy of our business magazine.
That is duplicitous.
No shots, no ill intent for the fine folks that worked on PC Magazine at the time, but that magazine did not align with my interests whatsoever.
I've probably got some in my parents' basement still. I don't remember for sure, but is it kind of the beige box, khaki wearing style of PC Magazine?
Yeah, like imagine a guy that had some stuff in holsters on his belt.
Okay, yeah.
And that also was really into contact management software, yep, or databases. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, what do you think about a work group printer, Brad?
Oh, I think that everybody should be able to print to the same printer,
yeah,
at any time.
Yeah, they didn't cover Doom for like a year. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I transitioned from PC Magazine to the internet, to the early internet in like 95 when I got on a shell account, a PPP account. And then like 1997, I was at the screwdriver shop I've told this story before, but I was in the screwdriver shop in Knoxville, Tennessee, where I would buy like stuff that was expensive to ship when I was building new computers for people. So like cases basically and monitors. And the guy there was like, hey man, have you seen this new magazine? I was like, what are you talking about? Magazine? Who? It's the internet age, man. We don't use magazines. He's like, no, you should check out this Boot magazine, man. And I was like, wait, it's a magazine about, it's a shoe. Are you a foot guy? And he's like, no, it's Computer Boot.
I mean, yes, but also.
So I bought the, which was actually the September 1997 issue is the first one I picked up. This is the 13th issue. I was like, oh.
He was like, yo, look at these guys. The B is lowercase. That's how cool these guys are.
They're speaking my language, man. Here's the thing. They're into the same things I'm into. They're into like fast computers and 3D accelerators and like having a LAN at your house in 1997.
32-bit operating systems.
Yeah, it was a revelation. And honestly, like they did the first how to build your PC thing around the same time that I saw. Like I had, when I built my first PC, I read the how to on Tom's Hardware. Because there was a famous how to like end of 97, mid 97 sometime. It was like, hey, here's how to build a K6 or a Pentium computer with a socket 7 CPU. And I read all that, but then I needed to take the parts out of the old PC because some of them were going in the new PC. And I had to copy a Boot. And I flipped it open and I kept it open and I looked at the tiny little pictures on the page and I was like, okay, you do this and this and this and this and this. I think I can do it. And I only had to take the bits out that I needed to make the old PC work once to go back online and find out what I'd messed up before I finally got it up and running. And like that was the beginning of me. That was beginning of a nerd phase that's now lasted 30 some years. So
the rest was history. You know, we've violated TechPod law number one,
which is,
we've done the cold open about the episode topic. We got to pivot immediately.
Oh crap.
Apple pie.
What's your favorite? What's your St. Patrick's Day food?
Something old monitors.
Yeah, I really like hot sauce.
Hot sauce.
I barely knew her. We'll be right back. Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad.
I don't have, I got nothing. Now is the part where we usually do the thing that I just did. I fucked up. I'm sorry.
Got nothing. It's okay.
I messed it all up.
Too late. Nope. We're going. Yeah. We're already going. We're in it.
So we had some options for stories this week. Uh-huh. And kind of everything in the tech news right now, a little bit of a bummer. Uh-huh. And we already did a machine learning thing a few weeks ago.
Dude.
So GPT-4, we're not talking about that.
It's like everything is GPT-4 and Midjourney 5 right now. Like, we can't just do every other episode about AI.
At one point, well, I mean, that's what the singularity is all stories become about AI eventually.
I guess so.
I logged on to Mastodon. Everybody's like, oh man, everything I see on the internet is just bumming me out more this week. And then I was like, well, I'll go to Twitter and see if it's any better over there. And same post. It was the exact same post from a completely different person. It was like, everything on the internet is bumming me out more than the last thing I saw.
I can tell you with confidence, it is never better over on Twitter these days.
Oh yeah. No, it's not. Twitter is never good. It's always a mistake to go to Twitter. But anyway, so Mastodon generally pretty positive, but a lot of folks that I follow there are like run small businesses and were affected by the SVB stuff, even though it ended up being kind of okay. Anyway, we decided this week to do something that we haven't done in a minute and delve into a classic magazine issue.
That's right. We decided to take a trip back to a simpler time.
1996. September, but probably realistically like May or June, maybe even April.
Well, it's spoken like a magazine editor.
Yeah.
All I know is what's on the book.
Yeah. The book. So first issues are weird because they usually with a first issue of a magazine, you're not just writing the content of the magazine. You also have to figure out what the sections of the magazine are.
Right. And what the tone is.
And then you have to figure out the design, and you have to, like, usually it takes longer than a month to put together the first couple issues of a magazine. Cause there's some speed bumps, especially back then. Cause this would have all been done on Quark Express and then shot on film, which adds an extra like week to the whole process. So maybe two.
Did we say what we're doing? It's the first issue of Boot.
Yeah, this is the first issue of Boot Magazine.
Issue numero uno. We'll put a link to the PDF. It's right there on archive.org in the show notes.
This is the magazine that later on became Maximum PC, where I kind of where I became a magazine person. Mm-hmm. Boot ran from September of 96 until like, I think, August of 99 or 2000. Must have been 99. And then Future bought the list of a magazine called, I think, Home PC. And they combined Boot and Home PC. So Home PC was like this. It was like Good Housekeeping, but for computers.
Wait a minute.
If you wanted to find a magazine that would tell you how to like do your taxes or keep a family budget or have a recipe catalog.
Okay.
Home PC was it.
Okay. I was trying to understand. Cause I mean, we've talked about the beige box khaki PC magazines.
Yeah.
We've talked about the edgy gamer rags. I was trying to figure out where the kind of homemaking PC part fit in, but that makes sense.
Yeah. So, the thing I will say, I never actually read this copy of the magazine, this issue of the magazine. I don't think we didn't have very many of them at the office when I was there. So it wasn't, somebody scanned it a few years ago and put it on archive.org, which was kind of, we'll put a link to the show notes so you can follow along. I was surprised by how much conversation about erections there is in this magazine.
Yeah. I wasn't going to lead with that, but yes, like the Dream Machine cover story in this, like in paragraph one is like, don't do this. That's sissy stuff. You want to do that instead. You know, it's just it was the 90s.
The tone is very much of the 90s.
Although, like, frankly, this is kind of mild, I think, by the standards of the time, considering that like PC Accelerator was only a couple, 3 years away.
Well, yeah, PC Accelerator was a different PC Accelerator. They were trying to do like a UK style lad mag, but for video games.
Yes.
Of the folks that are on this initial masthead in 1998, John Phillips wrote a thing or two here. And Michael Brown, who ended up working with me when I was at Maximum PC, were the only ones there. There's some other names that you'll recognize that pop up here and there. But the tone, My understanding is that the tone, both in the office and of the magazine, changed pretty dramatically in the 2 years following the publication of between when this came out and when I started writing for the book.
That's so probably natural for any new thing of this nature, right?
Like not a bad thing.
You're going to try a bunch of stuff and then things are going to evolve. Can I just ask? I mean, yeah. I mean, yes. This respect, and this question is not really serious, but is Brad Dossland a real name?
Brad Dossland is Brad's real name. I didn't. So my overlap with Brad at the company was precisely one day. My first day at the magazine was his last day at Imagine. So I'd met him a couple of times at other things since then, but yeah.
I just Dossland is such an amazing name for somebody who runs a computer.
I think you pronounce it Dossland is how he says it.
Okay.
But I'm not sure.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, it is a funny name for a computer guy though. So, but it's not like a fake character. What's his name? Cringely on the back of the PC World, PC Mag issues was a completely made up character.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, or yes, your Sushi X's.
Your Sushi X or whatever. Yes, yeah, exactly. Yes. I was going to say, to give context, this is the first issue. Probably they worked on it for at least 2 months, maybe a little bit more. They rolled CD-ROM Today. Future had this magazine called CD-ROM Today that was like about all your multimedia shit that people clearly were not enthusiastic about anymore in mid-1996. And they rolled that magazine into this. So CD-ROM Today became Boot. And the letters section is clearly people responding to the news that CD-ROM Today was going to become Boot.
That was like one of my first questions was coming across the letters page in the first issue of this magazine. I was like, how did they get letters?
So typically you just made them up for the first episode, for the first issue of a new magazine.
Was that common?
So you would there were often preview issues. So you'd make like a preview, a little like 20 page preview thing that would go to advertisers and stuff so they could sell ads in it. Mm-hmm. And you would take those preview things and take them to other staffs at the publishing company and be like, hey, can you read this and write me a letter for this issue and give it a fake name?
Wait a minute. We could be doing Q&A episodes every week if we just made up all the questions.
Hey, Brad, what questions would you like to ask today? We did. People didn't always do that, but that was often what happened.
Man, everything I knew was a lie.
I mean, look, the thing you have to remember, and I say this with a lot of love, when you're sitting at home reading a magazine, you think, oh, man, these people are in an ivory tower on top of a hill. They're so smart. They know everything and they're working. They're like they're the best of the best of the best.
Yeah, they wouldn't have these jobs if they were not the best of the best, would they? Right.
Well, I mean, so realistically, the reason most magazine people had jobs, in my experience, was because they understood the topic pretty well, but were pretty good writers and could write consistently on deadlines.
Yes, that actually, now that you say that, and that all just went into kind of hyper gear once everything moved online. It was like, can you turn copy out very fast was kind of like the number one job requirement.
Yeah, it's like they hired me at MaxPC specifically because I understood the technology really well and I could write. And they needed somebody to make sure that like the staff over the years, that magazine staff became less and more technical over at different periods. And I came in at a time when we were probably at the nadir of technical, not like we weren't people who didn't use technology, but Gordon was on staff and pretty much nobody else was like a kind of gearhead numbers and bits person.
Yes.
So they brought me in to like fact check the entire magazine basically every month.
Whoa. That sounds like a lot.
I was 25 and had a lot of energy and a fair amount of free time and didn't believe in work-life balance at that point in my life. So, it was a lot.
A familiar story.
Yeah, exactly. You know the same people.
Yes. Let me ask real fast. Yeah. You said this spun out of a future book, but the Imagine.
It was Imagine at the time.
So you're using that as a stand-in. So,
well, so Imagine got bought by Future PLC in the UK in like 96, I think, sometime right before this.
Oh, okay.
Chris Anderson started them both, but he left he got run off from the UK or something and then ended up coming back triumphantly and taking, I don't remember the full story of that. That was before my time, but.
Okay. I bring this up because Next Generation magazine also started right around this time, maybe 95, if I had to guess. And like people, a lot of people will remember that as the somewhat highfalutin video game magazine with the extremely thick, glossy cover stock.
Well, it was, so at the time the common wisdom was, hey, you can't do a cross-platform game book because Nintendo people are going to buy Nintendo Power and PlayStation people are going to buy OPM or PSM, the PlayStation magazine, the unofficial one, et cetera. The thing about Next Gen was they thought that there was a high end market for game coverage, like it, like somewhere they live somewhere between like a high end enthusiast book and an industry trade book where they, where you were doing kind of like what became stuff you'd see in like Game Developer Magazine. They often had like interviews that got into like the business of games and stuff like that, in addition to just talking about which games ripped. And Next Gen, I don't know if this was true, but the joke at the office was always that Next Gen continued to run for so long, despite being tiny and making no money, because Bill Gates was known to read it and would give them interviews all the time.
Did it make no money?
Didn't make any money.
Interesting. So, okay. Like three things dovetailing together here. So on page 22.
Yes.
Gaming according to Gates, as you pointed out in the notes doc we made for this, they got an interview with Bill Gates in this thing and it wasn't even like the lead.
Yeah, but they didn't even make a feature out of it.
It's just this 2-page little interview at the front of the magazine about video games and Windows, according to Bill Gates. Chris Charla of Next Generation Magazine was involved in this interview. So like they mentioned right in the interview or in the intro to this piece here, Chris Charla of Boot's sister publication, Next Generation.
My guess is that they trotted Gates to E3 to talk about or GDC maybe to talk about what was going to be direct. I mean, I guess DirectX was out by that point, but he came to beat the drum for DirectX would be my guess. And they got a 10-minute interview with him at the booth would be my assumption. Charla now, of course, is id at Xbox and does indie games for Xbox.
Wait, is that how you say that? Id at Xbox?
Id at Xbox?
Oh,
I always say ID.
I always said ID at Xbox.
I don't know.
Let's get some marketing people on the phone.
Look, clear this up. Our my game is published by or not published by, but anyway.
Are you guys part of
we,
that?
Program? We associate with them on the regular. I have no idea how they say it.
I mean, that's a whole other tangential thing that people outside the games industry probably don't care as much about. But like, yeah, Charles has mentioned it here. Doug Lombardi is the news editor of this first issue.
He was the news editor for almost the whole first year. And then he went to work for Valve.
Yeah. And yes, Doug Lombardi, the very, very long time Valve PR guy who has just recently left, I believe.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. So we flagged a bunch of stuff to talk about in here.
But well, I mean, my point about how like these folks were putting together a really big magazine that covered a lot of stuff on like probably a $4,000 or $5,000 contributes budget, which sounds like a lot. But when you consider each review was probably $400 or $500, the art costs money, the photos cost money, everything costs money. It doesn't go very far. So everybody that was on the staff was writing stuff for these future books. That was the model. And like they were going, I mean, I know the joke that you web it people always used to say was that we would fuck around for 3 weeks and then bang out a magazine last week.
I'm not saying every magazine did that. I just got the impression the ones I knew were sort of that way.
If we had done that, then we would have, like with hardware stuff, you had to have the hardware stuff done because it had to be done in time to be photographed and have the photographs developed and put in the magazine, or else the issues just wouldn't get done.
Sure.
So, anyway, that's the end of my...
It's a pretty big spread in here of areas of coverage. I mean, this cover story is this dream $5,000 dream machine build, but then like there's an interview with Jean-Louis Gasset in here about the B-Box, which they were about to launch. And he's in there talking about C++ developers and courting them. And there's like stuff about T1s and ISDN lines in here. There's all kinds of like gadget PDA type reviews.
Web design stuff.
Yeah. There's a web design article. There's a whole game review section. There's a review of 3D Studio Max in here. There's a lot of stuff. There's a speaker roundup.
Yeah.
This magazine is like kind of all things to all people almost, it feels like.
Well, I mean, it was I think the idea originally was to make an enthusiast. I mean, it always was really, because even in Maximum PC, we tried to do the same thing. It was always a magazine for enthusiasts computer enthusiast who did whatever you could do with a computer. So it was a broad mandate. The thing that struck me just in general reading this, I don't think a lot of the people who were writing about this stuff were very good at the stuff that they were writing about sometimes. You know, like the 3D Studio Max review is clearly written by somebody who has used some software and not who is like a day-to-day 3D Studio Max user.
Yeah, I get it. Having done freelance myself not long after this, I kind of get it. You know, sometimes you get an assignment and you just need to make rent.
Yeah. I mean, you figure it out, and like no knock on whoever wrote that review. I apologize for being snarky about it. But like later on, like once the magazine was established, and definitely by the time I was in charge of it in like 2004, 2005, we would just say, no, we're not going to cover that because we can't find somebody who knows enough to do the review. Sure. But when you're starting on your fledgling, and also all of this stuff is a lot newer in 96, right? So you get the opportunity to try 3D Studio Max. And somebody's like, yeah, I'll try that. I'd like to see how that works. That's cool. And you make it work. Yeah. So, anyway, yeah, where do you want to start? We talked about Bill Gates. The Bill Gates interview has a real good quote where he says, let's see. He says,
the SGI stuff.
Yeah. He's like, in a couple of years, you know, the computer hardware is going to be good enough that we're going to be faster than the fastest SGI workstation, which turned out to be 100% true because the fastest SGI workstation was the same workstation that was available at this point 2 years later when they went out of business. So
a lot of things you can say about Bill Gates, but he nailed that one on the head. I mean, that's quite literally like the narrative is that's what put SGI out of business was the commodity x86 boxes.
Yeah.
I mean, at a tenth of the cost, right?
Working as intended. Bill Gates does like boxing games better on dedicated consoles, though. So you got that going for your Dreamcast.
I don't know how I glossed over this. This mock-up of Bill Gates as a like Virtua Fighter looking polygonal fighter.
Yep, that's $500 right there.
That's incredible. That is going to be the show art for this episode for sure. That's completely ridiculous. Let's see. Early on, did you see this little MMX article?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember the marketing blitz around MMX? If people don't remember, MMX was a set of extension.
Multimedia extensions. Yes.
Well, you know, it was a set of extensions to the x86 instruction set that Intel rolled out to accelerate multimedia functions. But I didn't know what an instruction set was in 1995, 96. All I remember was a kind of a marketing blitz around MMX. Does that ring any bells for you?
They spent a lot of money marketing it. The point of it was that it accelerated some floating point math that was important for video rendering and games, basically, but mostly video rendering.
That's kind of what I was going to bring up here. Like if I had read this article back then, I would have had a better idea of what MMX did, because like the deck on this article straight up talks about it accelerating matrix multiplication, fast Fourier and a discrete cosine transforms. It's like, oh, okay. There's actual math getting faster here. That makes sense. But at the time, the way they bandied that acronym around kind of made you feel like, oh, is this a thing that they're making a big deal out of that's going to actually make very little to no difference?
Well, so
but it was actually quite a big deal.
Well, I mean, it was a big deal more because it was the beginning of extensions to the x86 instruction set, right? Yeah. Like there's a bazillion of things like SSE and SSE2 and that stuff spawned out of beginning.
Even the AMD 64.
Yeah.
Extensions that everybody uses now.
Before this though, like I'm electrical engineers yell at me in the comments, I guess. But like I viewed this as them adding marketing to the 487 floating point math coprocessor that was part of the 4 series generation of processors.
Yeah, well, so it's consistent with the move from the 486 name to the Pentium name, right? Like Intel decided it was time to start branding and marketing all of their products, which like was of course the right thing to do.
Good idea. Yeah.
It worked.
Who knew? Yeah. This was interesting. I thought the interesting thing in the news section actually, it might be before this. Oh, did you see the Let's Do Lunch note on page 19 where they talked about Steven Spielberg officially entering the world of multimedia?
Oh,
when Knowledge Adventure releases his game Movie Maker.
Huh.
Is that the thing that Microsoft bought that became Microsoft Movie Maker?
Like 3D Movie Maker?
Or 3D Movie Maker, yeah.
I don't know. Knowledge Adventure Movie Maker. I'm not familiar with that.
You'll also note on that page, there's a headline that says smartphones for smart people. While so-called smart telephones offer a mind-boggling array of exciting new features, learning all the somewhat complicated functions requires training and often ends up in potentially valuable calls being lost. Like, this is just some business shit.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, it's the first time I probably ever saw smartphones.
Like I said, there's a pretty broad spread of subjects covered in here. I think you're right. I think I just found there's a bunch of YouTube videos like entitled things like Knowledge Adventure Logo Effects in Windows Movie Maker 2.6.
There you go.
So I think that probably did become Windows Movie Maker.
Or 3D Movie Maker.
Or something.
So it's funny because the design of this magazine carried forward into the early Maximum PCs, even to the point that I worked there. Like the framing, the black trim on the pages and the cutouts and all that stuff. It was very like, hey, we want to make a computer magazine that looks kind of like Thrasher.
Okay, that's not the reference point I was expecting, but is that what Thrasher? Did you read Thrasher?
When we did redesigns, we talked about Thrasher a lot.
Interesting.
Not in 2005, but in the early days. Yeah. Does
Thrasher still exist?
I have no idea.
They still have a website.
Should we give one of the, I like looking at the ads in the old magazines because it gives you a good point of reference for like,
yes,
what, like, just to be clear, the opening fold ad in this magazine was a Micron PC ad.
I hadn't thought about the name Micron in, I don't know, 20 something years, but before I became aware that you could build your own computers, I always thought of Micron as like the high end, like desirable pre-builts.
They were fancy, I think.
Yeah. I never had one, but I always like fawned over them in the magazines. I was like, man, if I had $7,649, because that's the most expensive model in this ad. If I had that much money, I would buy this. Is that a Pentium Pro? It is.
It's a Pentium Pro 200. Yeah.
I would buy this Pentium Pro 200 with 128 megabytes of RAM for, like I said, almost $7,700.
Anyway, yeah.
You know, I mean, this was the era of the Compaqs and Packard Bells, like the kind of big box all-in-one pre-built stuff that were maybe not as great, but then like if you wanted the upgrade mail order stuff, you would get a Gateway or maybe a Micron.
It was more if you wanted just exactly the thing you wanted instead of like whatever happened to be in the box at the store.
Yes.
But yeah, so like a mid-range $2,500 PC at this point was a Pentium 200, not a Pentium Pro, with an 8X SCSI CD-ROM drive. That was pretty nice if it had SCSI. Mm-hmm. And it had a 64-bit 3D videos, probably a Rage Pro, if I had to guess.
Okay.
Which would have run like MechWarrior 2, but not GL Quake, which wasn't out yet at this point, just to be clear.
What was the Rage? That was ATI, right?
ATI Rage Pro, yeah. And that would have been probably 8 megabytes of RAM, would be my guess. So a little thin by today's standards. And like a pretty good-sized hard drive was one gigabytes rather than, yeah. So,
okay. Yeah. That checks out.
Yeah. It was a different time. This was after Quake came out, but before GL Quake and Quake World came out.
Yes. This is like 2 months after Quake, or Quake would have been coming out around the time they were probably going to press with this.
Yeah. The Quake, Unreal. There's a preview for Unreal, I think, in this issue, but not a preview for Quake, because probably even Q3 test wasn't out yet, would be my guess. Anyway. Q3 test came out way before that.
Oh yeah,
that was 99. It was old news by the time this came out, I guess.
Yeah. Yes.
Let's see other stuff. There's a Shel Kimmon she was a web design person at that point, I think, who wrote about like what would have been called web creation software at that period, I guess.
Yes, she according to this is the web director for the Net magazine.
And she was the column. She was one of our, she was a long running column. She stayed for a long time.
Okay.
She wrote a story about ISDN, choosing between ISDN or cable modems in San Francisco in the mid 90s.
Interesting. And in retrospect, that's not even a choice, but go on.
Well, it is, because when she references cable modems, she tells what the installed base for cable modems is at that point, which was 50.
Households. Wow.
50.
In San Francisco?
In Northern California, but in the entire world, is my understanding. This was like during the beta rollout for cable modem technology with at home.
Yeah. I got my first cable connection in probably like 2001. So sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So this would have been, DSL was maybe starting to roll out, but I think even that was unusual at the time. And then she broke down the cost for ISDN in Northern California at that point, which was $125 for a one-time installation, plus a $35 one-time line installation, plus $25 a month in addition to usage charges. So that was how I, like, Tennessee didn't have ISDN usage charges, which was why I was able to get ISDN in Tennessee.
Sure. Imagine 28 megabytes per second.
28 megabytes per second. I would have murdered somebody for in 1996.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That goes without saying.
Megabytes or megabits? It would have been mega.
Well, she used capital B here.
Bits. She said megabytes. Yeah. See, this is why they needed a technical editor.
I was going by the literal reading of that, but maybe she meant megabits here.
Yeah. No, it would have been a 10 megabit connection. Probably should have been. Anyway, doesn't matter. It was still really fast.
Have you ever had functional DSL?
Yeah, I had DSL until I moved. I had DSL until 2006, probably.
Was that here?
Yeah.
Was 2007, it decent?
Maybe.
Was it functional?
I had SDSL from COVAD.
Okay.
Which was a pack. They sub-licensed lines from Pac Bell. And it was the only way I could get symmetrical connections. So I had like a 2 megabit per second both ways.
Mm, okay.
Which was okay.
At the time, that's not terrible.
No, it wasn't great. I switched to cable when we started doing podcasts because I wanted to be able to upload stuff at home, and it took too long on the 2 megabit.
Yeah, we got a speakeasy connection when I moved here 20 years ago. Yeah,
that's what I did.
And it was god awful, but I think that was because the copper lines going into our crappy apartment were probably, I don't, 75, not, probably not that old, but very old.
Yeah, no, our speakeasy connection was fantastic. I really liked it.
Oh, really?
Okay, yeah, we had no problems.
Ours was not stable.
It was consistent and reliable.
Okay. I both moved out of that apartment after a year and also ran screaming to a Comcast connection, which tell you how badly I needed something better.
My experience with Comcast was really good right up until we moved into this house where there's been Comcast needs to service this connection, this wire, for the entire time I've lived here, which is now we're like 15 years into this house. Doesn't feel like it's been that long. Anyway, yeah. So I think that's the big one. Oh, the other thing about this issue that I thought was really funny is I had never seen a magazine. This would have, like, the fact that they opened the case sides on the computer reviews, because they have a feature that's a roundup of like 3 or 4 200 megahertz Pentiums. They popped the case side off, and I believe that the vendors were super pissed that they opened the case sides and showed them. Yeah.
Like I looked at that article with great interest because of course I did. And there's some weird stuff in here. Like this compact Presario, all the expansion cards fit into this like removable.
Oh yeah.
Card cage.
Compact loves a riser board.
That's, I had never seen anything like this before. It seems kind of convenient actually.
Well, except if you need to replace the motherboard, you're completely hosed because nobody else sells one that's anything like that.
Oh, I forgot Compaq was making its own boards. Wasn't it at that time?
Yeah. Compaq. Well, as soon as Compaq switched to those weird plastic front cases, that everything inside was weird. I think Compaq and even early Dells would do like left-handed cases. So the PCI Express slots would be oriented backwards. So you could use cards from other people, but you couldn't replace a motherboard in those cases because the stuff didn't line up right.
That's right, man. This, reading this stuff is bringing 1,000 memories back, but I never owned a Compaq, but that's one of them I remember now. Like that was the reputation around Compaq was like, hey, everything is totally unique and bespoke and made by them. Like you can't upgrade anything in this thing.
The thing I love about this is like how just spectacularly like their wiring jobs are really funny.
Yeah. Yes. That's why I love having these photos on here. Like this IBM Aptiva, like the power cable for the motherboard, like runs right between the two PCI slots.
Yep.
That seems problematic if you want to put two cards in.
The cards were one slot thick always then.
Yeah.
But the NEC PowerPlayer 2001 also has a weird riser board off of it that all the slots are on. So it's like there's a bus that connects to. So the motherboard sits on the bottom of the case, not the normal backplane. And then the riser board comes off of it and you plug the cards into that riser board. It's a choice. But that machine had a 3DFX Voodoo card in it.
That's true.
It was a good one.
A lot of companies doing a lot of wild shit with pre-built computers back then.
It's worth noting. So later on, they wouldn't have done this kind of thing without putting numbers on these reviews. So they would have rated these products because they wouldn't have done like a cushy, hey, here's just a roundup of some shit you can buy without saying this is the good one.
Oh, man, this NEC came with a copy of Battle Arena Toshinden for the Voodoo.
Yeah, they also did. They did a classic mid-90s computer vendor thing, which is like, hey, man, we're going to put a joystick in here, too. And maybe a gamepad. You like gamepads, right?
There are a number of shots of gamepads throughout this issue, and all of them make me feel queasy.
Some bad fight pads from back then.
There were some terrible controllers on PC in this time.
That there was Bill Gates referenced the Sidewinder gamepad in his thing. And that was an all-time bad gamepad.
Look at that thing. Like the D-pad on that thing looks like a wad of chewing gum. Like it's completely amorphous. It has no shape to it at all.
I don't, at least it had six buttons.
Yeah. Okay. Like, fine.
Yeah. Sure. I don't know. It's, but you always had to bind everything to everything. It was not a great time.
Yeah.
That was when you couldn't do a plus though. Cause Nintendo still had that was still patented, right?
I think is that not still the case?
No, it's fair game because Microsoft had a plus on the Xbox 360.
I want to say that Microsoft did something that got around that. Gosh, now I need to know.
Well, while you're looking that up, we can talk about, let's see, the other stuff. There's a Tom McDonald who wrote columns for a ton of computer magazines back in the day.
Wait, I'm sorry. Do you mean T. Liam McDonald?
Yeah, T. Liam is Tom McDonald.
No, I know. I was being a little bit facetious there, but the point is, like, I don't know why when I saw T. Liam McDonald's name in this, I was like, oh my god, didn't he have a column in like every PC magazine
we had
ever back then? I remember seeing a ton of his columns under that byline back then.
We had two Toms. So we had Tom Halfhill wrote a CPU like a Valley kind of fab and chip technology column. Okay. So I feel like that's why I don't remember if we asked. I don't know if they asked Tom McDonald to go by T. Liam or if that's just what his pen name was.
Interesting. Yeah, like something about also just that first initial middle name last name construction is just kind of like mysterious and authoritative sounding. It's like, oh man, anybody who goes by that in their byline must really know their shit.
Well, so when I started, John Phillips was like, hey, do you want to go by Verlin or like V. William or V. Liam or something? William, and I was like, I can't do V. Liam because we already have a T. Liam. That would be really stupid.
Anyway, just to hear the man debased by calling him Tom McDonald is just like, it really threw me for a loop. Also, he starts this column by saying, I hate Myst.
I mean, look, that was a popular vibe.
It's true.
In the age of real time graphics.
You know, it's true. A lot of people got a lot of mileage out of hating Myst back then.
I think the good news is now he can play Myst in real time. He can just bad boy up, 3D render, and he can just get in there.
That's right. Has anybody modded a rocket launcher into that real Myst?
I don't know.
I hope so.
Let's see, other things I loved on page 35, there's like hey, here's the stuff we're excited about. And on page 34, there's a hanging TV that's a plasma, early plasma from Sony that has the thickest bezel I've ever seen.
Yes. Is that 12 inch? No.
Oh, it goes up to 50.
Okay.
On page 34, the first one of those US robotics triple prong boomerang conference room phones.
Mm-hmm. Oh god.
That every conference room in the country has in it now.
Uh-huh.
And then on page 35, the thing that I am blown away by is this Panasonic CF62 laptop, which was $7,200.
Wow.
It has a motorized keyboard that pops up to reveal a CD-ROM drive.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah, so you can put your CD-ROMs in, but it unfolds the entire laptop. That thing, I can't imagine that thing lasted like four disk insertion and ejects. Like, what a nightmare. Anyway.
There's got to be video of that thing operating out there, right?
I'm sure somebody has one. There were a lot of weird, like a lot of weird mechanical engineers doing weird stuff in the laptop world in that time period.
There's not a lot out there about that thing, actually. I wonder if they didn't make a lot of those.
What about the Nintendo D-pad patent? Is that a real thing? Is that just urban legend?
I mean, I've been coming upon like Reddit threads. Those are, you know, you always want to like double confirm what you see in those. I think it may have expired at this point. Yes, that did expire in 2005.
Worldwide, okay. 1985. Yeah, it's expired.
Okay. I had thought Microsoft had just like done some very subtle thing to get around it, but I think that it's just fair game at this point. Yeah. Although Microsoft is back to a disc now.
Yeah, I that one is okay. I like the plus one better.
Yeah, yes. I like the D-pad on the Xbox One controllers. I thought was pretty good.
Yeah, it was fine. A little squishy.
Yes. Do you want to talk about this interview with Jean-Louis Gasset a little bit?
Yeah, he just starts off. He just goes right at it with some real racist shit. And then
he does mention political correctness in the first answer.
I mean, it's a very French approach to American politics in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
This was interesting because this interview would have happened before the B-boxes shipped. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not. They debuted in 1995 and they were upgraded in 1996, in August of 1996. I don't know when they actually started shipping though. So B, if people don't know, Jean-Louis was an Apple executive who left Apple and made the other company that was former Apple engineers making some bespoke hardware and bespoke OS that wasn't Next. And it was the one that Apple didn't choose to go with when they brought Steve Jobs back into the company and acquired Next.
When it was Gil Emilio on the way out and they were about to go bankrupt in 90 days. And it was like, God, what do we do? It was either buy Next or buy B, right?
Yeah.
And either bring in Steve Jobs or Gasset to run Apple.
Yeah.
Although Gasset is in this article saying, no, I will never go back to Apple in here. Well,
Jobs also said the same thing at the same time period. So.
Yeah. Well, he founded the company. He's got a connection there.
Yeah. Yeah. But the point is, the B machine was like, hey, we're going to start from scratch. We're going to take everything we learned making these first waves of computers. And we're going to build a like no backward compatibility, no legacy, just like designed to be massively parallel and work with a lot of like you're going to put a bunch of cheap, slow CPUs in here and it's going to run real fast.
Right.
And the demo of this B-box, which was like a couple of 66 megahertz processors, it wasn't super fast, was basically like, hey, look, we can open like six videos at a time on this thing, which was nuts.
I think he says in here they got like a standing ovation from developers watching this demo or something. There's
a fair amount of hyperbole in this interview for what it's worth.
He is like they describe him as a flamboyant Frenchman in this article. Like he's got a reputation for being like an outsized personality, right?
By they, you mean Doug Lombardi?
Yeah. They, yes. The authors.
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
He was part of it. So the interview, they did an interview every month. It was called Lip. The section was called Lip. It sometimes was a feature. Sometimes it was just a interview. Sometimes they didn't run it, but they always got people like Alex St. John was featured in Lip later on.
Okay.
They had Carmack in Lip. Like they would get people who would talk some real smack about people and they encouraged it. Right.
Yeah. I mean, at one point he's talking smack about his own product though. he's saying like, hey, if you want to buy a B-box, you should have two computers because I'll just read. Seriously, the reason I ask people to have two PCs or more is the lack of applications on the B-box. It's intolerable if you don't already have PCs or cannot program.
Well, I mean, like, but his point was it's essentially a dev kit for for the OS to come, right?
Yes, he does go on to elaborate here that like they're looking for people to make software for this thing. Like I don't know if I can find it. He says in here somewhere like they flat out subsidized heavily the cost of the box to people.
Yeah.
Could prove they would develop applications for it, like less than $1,000 for one of these things.
Yeah. And they would subsidize to if you were a developer, they would give you a price cut on the machine.
Yeah.
Like if you weren't, you had to pay the full price.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's some interesting stuff in here. Like they ask him about Commodore and the Amiga. They ask him about Next.
Well, it's interesting because like in the modern context, he doesn't really have like, he doesn't have a good, hey, here's who this machine is for in this interview, which is like what you think. Like, he's like, media people can use it, programmers can use it, blah, 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 blah. But he doesn't say, hey, if you want to edit video, this is the thing for you. It wasn't like he was saying, we're going to make a video toaster. He kind of whiffed on this whole thing all the way through. And he did make a bunch of really good flamboyant claims. Hey, we're going to sell 100,000 of these in the first year. Brad, do you know how many they actually sold?
How many did they sell?
About 1,800.
Oh my God. Wait, like lifetime?
Uh-huh.
No.
Well, because what happened was it became clear that making hardware was a bad idea. And so they switched to running on PowerPC Macs. And you could just buy the OS and then install on your PowerPC Mac and later on your x86 machines as well with the 4.0 release of the OS.
Like x86 makes more sense, but like, why would you buy a Mac just to put a different operating system on it? Like, if you're buying a Mac, you're there for the Apple experience, right? Well,
see, you say that, but this was in the time of System 7.
Yes.
And when System 8 was taking 5 years and Windows 95 had taken five years. And he was like, there's a window for other OSs back then.
That's fair. I forgot that Apple was kind of lost in the wilderness with their operating system at the time. 1,800 units.
1,800 units.
Oh my God, man.
It's not great.
I feel like nausea.
That's according to Wikipedia, for what it's worth.
That is incredible.
Yeah, I bet they were mostly to developers.
Absolutely.
They come up on eBay occasionally. I've looked at them and thought maybe I should buy a B-Box, but they've moved out of my price range in the last few years.
That few of them and probably even fewer that would still work.
They're pretty easy. I think they'd be pretty easy to manage, but
sure.
So it's an interesting interview. They did a jump. We stopped doing jumps to the back of the magazine. I hate jumps. The design on this thing is a trip though. There's so much text on these pages compared to later on.
What is a jump exactly?
Jump is when you go, when it's like, hey, interview continues on page 120.
Oh, okay. Wow. I never knew the term of art for that. The jargon.
I will say, if you look on the bottom of page 41, you can see a little graphic that says the BOS facilitates multitasking is the caption, including rendering fractals, display FMB and mixing multi-channel audio. It has the little context pane, the contacts icon with the three guys. It's a fabulous icon.
Yes, I fawned over that screenshot actually in this.
Yeah, whoever they had designing their icons, I assume it was somebody from early Apple, did a just absolutely delightful job with the icon design.
B had some fantastic logo design, kind of all the design around B was very nice. Well, the case, I don't know. I'm a little mixed on the case now that I see it again.
The actual case?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, man, it was not a good time for PC case design in the mid 90s.
Fair. But the OS design, the UI design and the graphic design and all that stuff were top notch.
Yeah. They had their window Chrome was really lovely.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's see. They had a flight sim article later on.
Like a kind of a real time, the future of flight simulators. Like it's kind of like, here's what all this new hardware is going to mean for flight simulators.
Though it's 5 years old, Falcon 3.0 remains the benchmark for many virtual pilots. With the scheduled winter arrival of Falcon 4.0, Brad, do you know when Falcon 4.0 shipped?
You flagged that in the notes and I had forgotten. Wasn't Falcon 4.0 like a legendary boondoggle?
It was historically late. Historically delayed
and like super broken right when it came out,
or? I don't know if it ever became not broken,
not what was promised, let's say.
It shipped on the 11th of December 1998, so it shipped 2 full years late. In fairness, they probably had to ship that late because the 3D accelerators, they were going to do 3D acceleration, and the 3D accelerators at the time couldn't handle what was going on in a flight sim. That was the problem.
Maybe don't bet your franchise on an emerging bleeding edge technology.
Yeah, they did an Intel API. That's what they started on, which was probably a mistake in retrospect.
The Falcon games were also the ones with the phone book sized manuals, right?
Yeah, the binder came in. Falcon 3.0's manual came in a binder, which I still had that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Let's see. As we were going through this issue on Discord,
Yes. No, go ahead.
You messaged me at one point and said they reviewed your speakers in here.
Oh yeah.
Well, at which point I was like, now we have to do this episode. not exactly this. What they reviewed is what looks like the sort of nicer high end original version of the speakers that I still have on my desk today. And I got I bought the cheaper mass market plastic ones that came out 3 or 4 years later.
Well, there you go.
We're talking about this was a hands-on test in a hotel suite. They say
there are no reviews in this thing.
Yeah. I get it. The Cambridge Soundworks MicroWorks for $349, but it's the classic Cambridge little power cubes, the desk cubes with the big subwoofer, except it's a big subwoofer. It's like twice the size of the one I have. Same cubes, except, yeah, everything is metal. Like, these cubes are metal, not plastic. So
your cubes are metal or your cubes are plastic?
Mine are plastic.
Oh, the ones I had on my bench were metal. They were heavy.
Wow. Do you still have them?
No, I didn't. Oh. I left them when I left Max PC.
Oh.
15 years ago, 13 years ago.
I think mine were like $99. I feel like I remember it was like, oh my God, these speakers are affordable and sound amazing. Holy crap.
That was where I had the Altec Lansing ACS 48s that were in the same like $110 price range or something. I like in this issue, in that Fight Sim article, they talked about force feedback and they explained how force feedback worked in arcades versus in like Rumble on different games.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. They're like, hey, we're going to be able to simulate real physics on the desktop here real soon.
That was a lofty claim, but sure.
Can we talk about the Dream Machine?
Yes, that's the cover story. That's probably the last big thing to talk about here, right?
I think so, probably.
The only other ad I mentioned, let's see. Oh, well, no, we didn't talk about the ads yet, did we?
We talked a little bit about them, but not a ton.
All right, let's do the Dream Machine, and then we can wrap up with a few ads.
So did you notice anything missing? The Dream Machine, every year, Maximum PC did in September, increasingly ridiculous build. Usually the idea was hey, what's the nicest computer we can build, right? Sometimes we do a lean machine, which was a budget, more budget oriented PC that was like a no compromises budget machine. But the Dream Machine was supposed to be like, usually there was a little bit of a hook. Sometimes we'd put a stupid screen in it, put something unnecessary but fun was often the idea. Or we'd get it chromed or get a fancy paint job or, you know, whatever, something that a normal person might not do, but it'd be exciting. Put six monitors on it. Right. In the CRT days, just to be clear, six monitors, CRT days, pretty substantial undertaking.
That's a commitment. I don't even know where you would put all those.
Well, you had to get a rack and you had to run the extra power from across the room on a different circuit is the answer to that question. Anyway, but the rule was it had to work and there had to be benchmarks. Except no benchmarks.
Didn't even occur to me that, there's not really any sign in here of them using it.
Nope. They don't talk about building it. They don't mention building it. They just list a bunch of parts. And I haven't confirmed with anybody who was there. I don't know that John was there yet for this one. I think he was just a contributor because I think he was still on the net. But yeah, I am not sure that they actually built this machine ever.
Scandal.
I know. We built all of the ones that were while I was there. I can guarantee that. But yeah, they talked, it's a lot of like theoretic, it's theory crafting more than actual building, I think.
Yeah. Another thing that, another memory that this issue jogged was in this Dream Machine build where they're talking about choice of CPU. They're flat out. I had completely forgotten about this. They're flat out like, hey, are you running Windows 95 and DOS? Are you playing a lot of games? Then you want a Pentium. Because Pentium Pros suck ass at 16-bit software.
Yes, 16-bit, their 16-bit emulation stuff was bad.
Right. I had completely forgotten that the Pentium Pro, the big new next generation CPU from Intel, ran previous software like shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're like, hey, if you're on NT4, if you're doing like big workstation stuff, of course, 32-bit stuff in particular, a Pentium Pro obviously makes sense. But
I mean, not much was doing 32-bit at that point. Like if you were doing 3D modeling and stuff like that, maybe.
Yes.
But there wasn't really even a lot of video editing on the PC at this point. Like the video editing tools at this point were thin.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't even get drivers for everything in Windows NT at the time. I was getting there, but
if you had a workstation type graphics card, you absolutely could. But if you wanted drivers for a Voodoo card, you were hosed. Yeah,
that's what I mean. Like consumer level stuff that you might just happen to have, at your desk.
Yeah.
The bigger thing though, is just, this just reminds me that the Pentium Pro was like kind of a, I shouldn't say a failed launch exactly, but like it.
Well, it was a workstation part.
Well, okay, maybe. Yeah, you're right. I guess they did like position it more as a high end like server and professional kind of thing.
The failure on the Pentium Pro was that they couldn't unit test the cache. So the Pentium Pro was a 32 bit processor that they fused some really fast full speed L2 cache onto the chip. It was a big L2 cache, bigger than you could put on the die at the time, and L2 cache is like short-term memory for the CPU. They fused it on, and you couldn't unit test the cache or the CPU before they were fused. So if either one of them were duds out of the manufacturing process, you wouldn't find out until you'd burned one that was potentially good. So their yields were half what they expect, or quarter what they expected, third what they expected to be. I can't remember. Like the math was bad on them. And they ended up having to charge a really high premium for them, which is why the Pentium 2, which came out later the next year, later in 97 even, was a separate cache. Everything was on a daughter board. So the CPU and the cache were on daughter boards.
Oh,
and
they could
test each one individually. And if you had a dud, you'd find out before you physically attached them to each other in a permanent way.
Okay. I always wondered why the Pentium 2 had that bizarre design.
But it was half speed was the the trade-off, was the cache to CPU conversation happened at every other clock instead of every clock. So
yeah, I mean the Pentium Pro, like the P6 architecture was the basis of their entire product line for the next like several years, right?
Yeah, that CPU formed the basis. They also improved the 16-bit performance in the Pentium 2 eventually.
Right. Right.
But yeah, so the Dream Machine, first one, let's say kind of bullshit. This is before Andrew Sanchez started working there too. He was like the first, not that the other guys weren't real nerds, but like he was a real nerd by all reports. I never knew Andrew. He passed before I started working there. But yeah,
do you know what happened to the Dream Machine every year after all the coverage was done?
Depends on the year. Typically, like, one year we got like an early ATI or maybe it was AMD by then, but DX 8 or 9 part. So it was like a pre-pro part that had to go back to, like, often they would get taken apart and the parts would go back to manufacturers and stuff like that.
Okay.
We usually, the cases would stay around for a little bit if we did something custom to it. Cause like once one year, HP was making these amazing, I don't know if you remember the HP Voodoo cases where they were all like, they had cool fins and they were up on a stand and they were cantilevered and all that. We got HP to give us one of those and we got it chromed.
Huh?
That one, I think one of the editors ended up taking that one home, but I can't remember for sure. I have an old Dream Machine case in my garage that I haven't used in like 10 years. I need to take it to Gordon sometime when I go down for Full Nerd. I'll take it down for him. Because they have a place to display. Yeah.
Yes. They've got some interesting artifacts in there.
So that's it. Like others, they do a handful of reviews in the back. They did have the Boot Kick-Ass Product Award, which was like our editor's choice. Mm-hmm. They did not, however, do the traditional 1 to 10 review scale. Cause we eventually switched to a 1 to 10 with nines and tens, nines being eligible for a kick-ass if it was good, and tens always getting a kick-ass.
This review section is insane. It's literally everything that they could think of to review all in one section.
Well, that's how the reviews always were in Boot. It was always in the back.
The kick-ass product award went to Duke Nukem 3D. Right next to it is reviewed a Hewlett-Packard Pavilion 7130P. There's an RDC-1 digital camera reviewed in here. There is Frank Lloyd Wright presentation and conceptual drawings, which got an 87.
Yeah.
Let's see. Total Mayhem is in here. 3D Studio Max, as I said, and a color quick cam.
So a lot of this would happen. Battleground 3 Waterloo.
Yeah, it's just bizarre to see this broad a range of products all thrown into one review section.
Well, so this is the way the review section of the magazine often worked. So there was usually like an anchor PC review, like an enthusiast PC review that would range from a budget one all the way up to something really, really, really expensive and crazy. Then there'd be like some, like in the case hardware, like a video cards or sound cards or some sort of like network card or accelerator or something like that. SSDs, hard drives, whatever. And then there would be some peripheral stuff and software at the end. We eventually moved away from doing software just because it was too hard to review. Like it's hard if you're writing, like if you want to review some sort of content creation software for something that's a specialist software, you have to understand how to use it. And it was too expensive and too hard and time consuming to do that. I feel like Nine Worlds being in here is the thing that happened because they used to be CD-ROM Today and they probably already had the review done for that before they decided to change the name.
Explore the solar system via disk and the web, it says.
There you go. Wait a minute.
Is that Patrick Stewart?
Is it Patrick Stewart?
That is the tiniest digital photo.
It does look like Patrick Stewart.
It sure does look like, oh yeah, no, I can just barely make out, hosted by Patrick. Wow.
Yeah, well, there you go. Him. He was in hot demand back then. Uh-huh. They had the Wingman Warrior. I don't know if you remember that, but that was a joystick plus a spinner. So you could play first person shooters with a joystick. So you use the spinner to turn and the joystick you'd use for movement, but there was no up and down. So maybe not that great. Huh. They also had a StarCraft preview, which I thought was funny. There were a couple of previews in here.
Oh, I missed that.
Will Wright's SimCopter was in here, and he has a quote that was like, man, we better hit. They were like, when is this coming out? And he was like, we better hit holiday or I'm going to be in real trouble. It came out holiday of that year. So good job.
SimCopter, huh?
Do you remember SimCopter?
I know. I was going to say, I don't think that's not one of the ones that gets a lot of the attention in the Will Wright oeuvre.
Okay. So SimCopter, there wasn't a lot of game there, but what you could do was import your SimCity 2000 save. And then you could load up a helicopter and fly around your city in the helicopter and like rescue people from burning buildings and put out fires. And I think that's pretty much it. Like, you do two things, maybe three.
They promised to simulate a helicopter and they did it.
Not a fabulous game, but it was indeed a game and it shipped on time.
I found the StarCraft preview. Sure enough, I wondered if this would be the case. It is. It's the version of StarCraft from before they completely overhauled and remade the whole thing.
Yeah.
When it had that very bad showing.
Yeah, it was like a 3D space with 2D graphics kind of thing, I think.
Well, yeah, if I'd have to go double check. My memory of what happened is essentially that people very sort of derisively started calling it Warcraft in Space.
Oh yeah, of course.
Like it just like kind of did not do anything to evolve the game that they had made already, except put an alien graphics in. Mm. And I think they took that to heart.
There you go.
Threw out everything they had and started over.
They have phone numbers in here for all of these software companies. That's a terrible idea.
So weird. God, you're right. At the end of the StarCraft preview is a phone number for Blizzard.
Yeah.
What?
If you want to call the makers of Drowned God, Inkscape, you can call them at 800-693-3253.
Why would you do this?
People used to use the phone for Unreal. There's a preview for Unreal in here. This Unreal preview is a trip. It has a screenshot from the Unreal ad too, which is hilarious. Yeah,
that's cool to see. Oh, that's right. This preview of Unreal mentions that MMX was tied in with Unreal quite tightly.
Yeah, you couldn't get colored lights without MMX.
That's right. I forgot about that.
So yeah, that's it. That's the first issue of Boot Magazine.
Yeah. Like we said, we will put a link to the PDF in the show notes if you want to read this issue yourself.
It's kind of a trip. Like I said, we didn't have any, like none survived to my time at Imagine. So, it's cool that it's on archive.org. I appreciate it. Thank you to whoever uploaded it and did the scanning.
Yes. Real quick. We did promise ads.
Oh yeah.
You wrote down that the Creative Graphics Blaster MA302 is in here.
Yeah, that's a Cirrus Logic. I looked it up. It's a Cirrus Logic chipset. It was notable because it supported up to 1600 by 1200 in 2D with video rendering.
That is pretty notable at this time. It also just reminds me, Creative Labs, of course, the makers of Sound Blaster, if you don't know somehow.
I think that's fair.
It reminds me that they did start trying to blast out into other blaster categories.
Yep.
Like there was Graphics Blaster. Didn't they make a 3D Blaster?
Well, 3D Blaster was, they made a couple of them. The notable one was a Voodoo card. They made a Voodoo 2 card, I think, eventually.
I'd swear there were others, right? Weren't there other blasters?
There was a Phone Blaster.
Okay.
Modem Blaster.
Yes. Was it literally called Phone Blaster? Might have
been called Modem Blaster, but you plugged into the phone line.
Please let that be a thing. That's totally a thing.
Yeah, Creative Labs Modem Blaster V.92 PCI. It's a hot modem action there.
I have found a Phone Blaster on eBay.
Is that a modem thing too? Or is that, I think that's a thing that hangs up on people for you.
Creative CT3110, a Phone Blaster.
Oh man. I like at the end of this magazine, they clearly like were like, oh shit, we gotta fill two more pages. There's here's a section where if you send us product announcements, we'll just print them as you write them. I don't think I think they actually rewrote them a little bit, at least it looks like.
Okay. But,
yeah. Anyway,
there's also this gossip page.
That's fake.
Okay.
That's glitch. So the last page of the book was always glitch, which was a joke of, let's say, look, it was up and down. John really nailed it some months, and some months not so much. The Bitchin' Fast 3D video card, Bitchin' Fast 3D 2000. It was a joke, but it included every 3D chip. When there were like 8 companies making 3D graphics chipsets, it included all of them. So, which was clearly not going to happen. Here's this. I'll send you the link.
All right. Last ad that I mentioned, there's an Earthlink ad in here.
Yeah.
$19.95 a month for internet access, unlimited.
$19.95 a month. Wow.
They make a big deal out of it being unlimited, though. I was trying to remember, like, were ISPs metering by time, like connection time, or by data back then?
No, nobody metered by shit in the dial-up days.
Did they not?
That's not true. There were probably some people that were still kicking you off if you're on for like extended periods of hours or whatever.
Okay. Well, like I said, they make a big deal in this ad about it being unlimited. So maybe that was an AOL thing.
AOL always would say it was, you'd get 3,000 hours a month, but it was always like, it very quickly became that you had more hours than you could physically be online in the month with AOL.
Sure. Wait, did they carry over?
No, but they just kept making the number bigger because it didn't matter.
Oh, well, because at that point, they were probably losing market share, right?
Not at this point, no. AOL continued to grow until like early 2000s when broadband took off.
Did it really? That's it's page 17, if you want to find the ad.
Page 17. I just wanted, for people who are reading along at home. Wow, it has a cake.
Mm-hmm. That's all the internet you can eat. Pig out, it says. $19.95 flat rate.
And Netscape Navigator is included. I had Earthlink for a little bit. I don't know about this. I don't know. My guess is that's a response to AOL saying, hey, you get a 500 hours a month or something.
Sure.
I can't imagine people being on the internet for much more than that back then.
Oh, I can.
I mean, I guess when you put it that way, when you think about it taking, let's see, you got basically 1 kilobyte per second. So a 400 kilobyte file would take four minutes to download, minutes to download. Yeah, I guess probably. Mm-hmm. That's not right, is it? 100 kilobits per minute. 28.8 kilobits per second. No, that's probably about right. It was slow. Anyway, you know what's not slow, Brad?
What's that?
Our patrons.
Wait, really? How do you know? Like, what is that? By what metric are you measuring the speed of our patron?
I'm making an assumption. I was kind of just trying to do a segue into the next thing.
Okay.
But yeah, we are always grateful to our patrons for their support.
It's true. We are.
Thank you, patrons.
Thank you, patrons.
It's gotten really warm in my office while we've been recording this podcast. I think
it's technically still winter for another, 5 days? When's the...
March 21st.
Oh, 4 days. Okay. It's technically still winter and it feels like summer outside.
Oh, is it nice out? I haven't left my hole all day. I've been trapped in here.
It was quite warm today.
Well, anyway, we want to thank our patrons, but especially our executive producer tier patrons, including...
Thank you, patrons, for listening to us talk about the weather.
Yeah, and old stuff. If you like the show, please let us know. We never know about these. Sometimes some people seem to really like them. Some people are very anti them. So if you didn't like them, like it, maybe skip this one. I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair. Look, retro computing is pretty hot these days. You know, there's clearly an audience for
that's
it.
True. That's true. But we want to thank our executive producer tier patrons, including Nick Johnston, Paddle Creek Games, makers of Fractured Veil, Andrew Slosky, Octothorpe, Hashtag Bunny Crimes, Just Wedge, Joel Krauska, Twinkle Twinkie, David Allen, and James Kamek. Thank you all so much. We do really appreciate you.
Yes. Yes, we do.
And we hope everybody has a lovely week. We will be back next week with another edition of the Tech Pod. See y'all then. Right.
It's questions. Wait, I'm hijacking this.
Oh, it's questions. Questions.
Next week is questions.
How get is your it questions question in. Time already, Brad?
Get your questions in.
Oh, man. How do you get questions in?
You go to questions seeking answers
on the Discord
channel. They're named.
Yeah.
On the Discord.
Or you can send an email to techpod@content.town.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry. What was that email address?
That email address is techpod@content.town.
Got it.
We will turn your Q into A's, maybe.
That's right.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.